All right, sorry for the technical delay. I tried to be on time. So thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great honor and pleasure to be here. So I will try not to defend, but at least to give my view on the machine learning side, which I think is a good continuation of the previous talk. Even though I was trained in statistics, you know, there is not a clear gap between statistics and machine learning. So certainly, I'm not working on epidemiology myself. I'm more interested in applications in genomics and some different aspects of cancer research in particular. So I will not take examples in epidemiology really, but try to give you some you know, view of what's the current state of the art of machine learning, the use of machine learning in some fields of clinical applications. And try to discuss some you know, advantages and limitations of these types of approaches. So first, again, I was saying I'm not okay. I realize left part of my slides will be cut. Let me try just to restart the full screen mode. Okay, we'll try to work without the left. That's better. Yeah, so first, when I say machine learning, precision medicine, just to set the stage, I try to work particularly on cancer research, and the reason why we could say let's do precision or personalized medicine is quite obvious in this domain. It's like when you go to the hospital and take two patients with the same cancer, you know, breast cancer, early stage with some phenotypic characterization. When you look inside of the cells, you look at the genomes, not only were the persons different at birth, and this is what genetics tells us, but also when you look at the cancer cells, you know, the cancer is a disease that grows in one's body, so it starts from a unique person's own cells and then gets mutations and other genetic events that lead to very different landscapes of genomic abnormalities when you look at the cancer treated in the hospital. And so nowadays, we tend to say all these cancers are this type of cancer, so you know, let's treat them the same way. And it's well known that, in particular in cancer, there is a big uncertainty on the fact that the disease is cured or not after some treatments, after surgery. There is big uncertainty on the fact that some treatments, especially targeted therapies, will be effective or not on a patient. And it kind of makes sense that this uncertainty can be related to the diversity we observe, and we can see it nowadays with sequencing and imaging techniques, right? So there is this clear view that maybe if we can characterize, I don't know what the good level is, but if we can characterize the diversity of the diseases we get at the hospital, maybe we can relate them to the diversity we should have in the treatment, right? And ideally adapt each treatment to each specificity of the disease in each patient, right? So this is more or less this general idea of precision medicine, personalized medicine, that says that if you see a bunch of, you know, it's not a cohort, it's just people coming to the hospital with a disease, maybe we can analyze data on these patients, and this could be imaging data, genetic data, health records, whatever data we have, and from this data, observe, so we see diversity, but the challenge is to organize this diversity maybe into patterns, or I don't know where up to which level the personalization has to go, but certainly to stratify the patient at some level where we are pretty sure that we give the good treatment and we take the good therapeutic decisions, right? And so in order to stratify a population like that, we need tools which sometimes we call algorithms, sometimes we call the decision trees or decision rules, that says that given this observation, I decide that this one person will be in this group and given this treatment. And the key challenge in many of these applications is how do you design, how do you fix the rules that will, you know, that will sort each patient, each individual, into a track to be treated in some way. So medicine is, of course, doctors do that all the time. This is what medicine somehow is about, diagnosis and taking good decisions. Difficulty is that doctors are not trained to analyze simultaneously hundreds of images, genetic data, and whatever other data we can collect, because we don't know, nobody yet knows the correct rule to really extract from the data the good decisions to, you know, to cure the disease in all the cases. Right? And so nowadays, so of course, statistics has always played a fundamental role in finding these rules, because most of the rules that we use nowadays have been, you know, are based on empirical observations that people with this particularity tend to respond well to this treatment. So there are clinical trials, etc., that end up with rules which are used then in the treatment. And the challenge is maybe to find new rules, because we have more data, we have access to more data. So how can we find new rules? And there is this feeling that maybe the standard way, you know, to pick, let's say, one marker here, test it in a clinical trial, and if it works, put it as a rule, does not scale anymore to the amount of data we can collect. So there is this envy, this will to say, maybe because we have so many data, so much data now, can we just try to go a bit faster and directly maybe make more complex, even though the goal is not to be complex, but just to say that because there are many data, can we make models that will use this data and find these rules? And it seems that nowadays, so what I will define as machine learning, which is not in a position, but let's say an expansion in statistics in this case, could play a role by being a bit, by providing tools that are pretty good at collecting this data. And when you compare complex data to some phenotype that we want to predict, at making a relationship, which is questionable for many things. We are not looking at causality, we are not looking at these kind of things, but at least in terms of prediction power, seems to be state of the art. So I guess there's lots of activity nowadays, to define prognostic markers, predictive markers, etc., based on machine learning approaches, which are a bit different from what we used to do in the previous decades. Right, so machine learning, let me just demystify what I mean by that. It's, as I said, for me, it's just a continuation of standard statistics. We said that logistic regression is the standard, the gold standard in GWAS, etc., linear models, etc. Machine learning, for me at least, is pretty much this, but in bigger space and with more complex data. But at the end of the day, even in neural networks, you know, we draw complex pictures, but the last layer is a logistic regression. It's no more than that. So, but then there is some question on what are the features you use. Okay, so in talks, machine learning, the machine learning we'll discuss is mostly a way when you have data and a task. So for example, here you see these dots, and there are two colors. To ask the machine, can you find a rule that would not only separate the black dots from the white dots, but more importantly, if you have a new dot, being able to predict the color. I think this is the main difference between the standard statistics and machine learning. We don't really care about assessing whether black and whites are different. We're not looking for p-values, etc., but we're looking for a rule which will be good at predicting the color of new points. Okay, and when you change, so this is mostly the criterion used, optimized by machine learning approaches, and therefore this difficulty sometimes to say, well, what is the statistical evidence, etc. Clearly, the only objective in machine learning is this. Maybe I oversimplify. There are lots of research trying to bridge the gaps, etc. But overall, the success of machine learning, which we hear about in the newspaper these days, is based on this idea that if you want to make a good prediction, like when you have a self-driving car, you want it to take a good decision, turn right or turn left, then this is what you have to solve as a problem, turn right or turn left based on the inputs you have. All right, so machine learning works well in some applications. You may have heard recently, this is just the press, that the Turing Award, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for Computer Science, was awarded to three important people in the field. Yann LeCun in particular, the French guy, and Geoff Hinton and Joshua Benjo. So not only them, of course, they're just representative, but let's say they were representative of this wave that managed a few years ago to bring back some old technology that didn't work before, so neural networks, and suddenly that works. I will try to explain why. And in the last 5 to 10 years, we have seen a breadth of new applications of these things. It doesn't mean that machine learning is all about this, but certainly the amount of products and research that has been triggered by this expansion of deep learning machine neural networks is impressive. So what is deep learning? There was the example of Google having tools to predict if you have a cat or not an image. So I will just take another example. Imagine you want to make a tool to predict if you have a penguin on an image, right? Here you have a penguin and you want to to have a model that says, yes, there is a penguin, or no, it's a tree, or it's a car. It's a very basic thing. This simple thing, which humans can do, by the way. So here we're just talking of things that, that a baby or a kid can do, or you can do. You can say if it's a tree or not. Used to be super challenging for computer scientists and mathematicians. Until 10 years ago, you know, the performance of the state of their models were very disappointing. Even though it seems to be a very trivial task, the performance was, let's say, in the 30% of accuracy. And what happened in the last 10 years is that we moved literally from 30% to 99%. So something happened. We have solved the problem, and this is why we talk a lot about this. 99% because it's a simple task, right? I don't claim it will solve all problems, but for simple tasks for perceptions, something happened. And so what happened is basically that we nowadays have a combination of lots of data, of good models for some data. So here I talk of images, and in images, the models which are used have been around for more than 10 years. They were already here in the 80s, the convolutional neural networks. So there is something specific about the data that is used here, what we know about the data. And of course, we need large computational power, which was key to do that. Like the models were already here 30 years ago, but we needed to run them many years 30 years ago to obtain the same performance that we get today in a few hours. We use clusters of GPUs, et cetera, and this is key to how these models work. Right, so simply speaking, when you combine lots of data, good models, and big computers, this is how you suddenly move the field from 30% to 99% accuracy, and so suddenly you solve a problem. So I would say that you know, this task is not interesting. Nobody cares about penguin prediction or cat prediction on images. But surprisingly enough, just you know, this task triggered a lot of applications in other fields. If you take your smartphone or your digital camera or your self-driving car, they all do image recognition, and more or less they use tools that were first derived from super simple tasks like object recognition. And more or less there is a possibility when you stay in the space of images to export some of the models to new tasks. And it goes as far, literally, as you know, when you have enough data to train a good model to discriminate cats and penguins and trees, more or less you can take this model and apply it to histopathology images in order to decide whether you know, you have cancer cells or not. So it seems to be very different images, but at least many things in the models capture things about images, about texture, etc. And somehow, of course, you do something, right? You don't take exactly the same model, but all the data which were collected on some tasks were able to learn parameters, etc., of a big model that can be adapted to some other applications. And this is key, I would say, to many applications in images, where because Google and other companies have lots of standard data, they are able to train big models for some tasks, and these models then can be exported and adapted to other tasks. So in the field of medicine, we hear a lot about, for example, these models to analyze medical images. There's lots of medical images. You can think of radiology, histopathology, skin images for dermatology, etc. And I think all these fields are being disrupted nowadays with, it's not always a clear win, but at least the fields are disrupted by these new technologies that suddenly bring tools that seem, you know, to have some applications very good performance. Right, so let me just mention a few of these applications to illustrate that I'm not talking of the future, I'm talking of today and products which are in clinical trials, which are sold by companies, which are published by academic labs. So a typical application would be when we talk of cancer, you know, we say nowadays, of course, we have doctors in the hospital that do this, but maybe they can be helped by tools like how to automatically read some histopathology images. So you have a slice of a tumor here, and you can imagine a tool that would recognize maybe the cancer cells, or maybe, you know, the next step that maybe not pathologists, but at least we dream about are, can we do better than pathologists? So it's a bit, of course, a non-consensual topic, but you know, sometimes we do all that for one purpose, which would be, for example, what's the risk of relapse? Let's do a prognosis. And nowadays, the risk of relapse is first evaluated by someone assessing the image, grading the image, I mean, looking at many features, and taking a decision. So maybe this is a case where you could imagine that if you directly try to relate the input image to the output survival or response to therapies, maybe it's possible to go directly from the image to the final output and not only try to mimic the doctor's decision, but maybe to learn something that could be probably very correlated to the doctor's decision, but could also capture things the doctor doesn't see today. This is the hope. I would say nowadays that there is no evidence in these fields that we have ever learned anything better than the doctors. The few publications are not convincing in terms of how, you know, better we could be. But what is more certain is that these tools can bring helpful resources for doctors. And, you know, we are in a place where we have the best, or we are near the best experts in the world. So I'm sure that, you know, people in this room will not need these tools. But when you think of the world and, you know, places where you have less expertise, then certainly we can maybe teach computers from experts and have these expertise being used more broadly. Right, so when I say it's not the future, it's really today. So there are many, I would just mention a few other things. So I'm working at Google now, so I will just mention a few of things that Google has published, but it's by no means unique. There are like literally tens of similar tools developed by other companies, labs, etc. So for example, if you have the question, can you recognize the cancer cells from this image? You need to be trained. So you know, myself, I have no idea. I know for this image, but it's normal people don't have. Nowadays, we have softwares that, you know, this is a zoom, but when you take a 100,000 by 100,000 megapixel image, it's the role of the pathologist to look everywhere and identify metastases or cancer cells. Well, nowadays, the computer does a pretty good job at that. It's not a complicated task, at least for the simple cases, which you know, the standard cases. And so you can imagine that this tool now works pretty well and is under clinical trial and soon will be implemented certainly in many hospitals because it clearly helps. And typically, you know, the clinical trials ongoing are not about, they are about the accuracy, but they are more about how much time do you gain when you use this tool as opposed to not using the tool. And so this is an example where the publication said that using the tool, trained pathologists could spend half the time they used to spend before because they focused with the same level of precision. So it's an impact which, you know, doesn't really change the decision, but improve the process. There are other examples. I will not spend too much time, but again, so this one is about diabetic retinopathy. So looking at this kind of images, again, this looks like very different images. So when you're a human a doctor, you need to be trained either on cancer cells or to be trained either on retina images. I think the algorithm, so the neural network that was used in both applications is more or less the same. It was fine-tuned on the two applications, but it's the same structure. It's starting from the same parameters. So there is this capacity, because these are images, really to export what has been learned on cats and dogs and to work on these images or to work on these images. And again, we, you know, these tools reach performance of experts. And so in these applications, so this is also a product by Google. You can read about that. No, typical application is this is discussed now in Thailand with the Ministry of Health, because this is you know, there are countries where you don't have enough. Even in Paris, it's hard to get a consultation when you want to see an ophthalmologist. If you go to Thailand, I think the ratio of doctors versus population is so tiny that these kind of tools could allow. It does not replace an expert, but at least it can allow many, many more people to have access to some fast diagnosis and then maybe prioritization to go to the system. Let me jump also, I like this new project. This is a project by Médecins Sans Frontières, the foundation, which is based in Paris, which recently was also funded by Google and its collaboration with other teams. So this thing is about machine learning. Again, it's not very challenging, I think, in machine learning. So it's not developed yet. It's a starting project. The goal is to develop an app on a smartphone to automatically read antibiograms. And so an antibiogram is just a way to test resistance to antibiotics of bacteria. So this is something which is used in the case of MSF in many refugee camps. So there are many local hospitals in the camps, and they don't have enough clinical expertise. So the current situation is they do tests in the camps, The pictures are sent to a central lab in Europe or in the US, which when they have time, they read the slide and say, well, because of that, you should give this antibiotic or not. And clearly, there is some, you know, some loss of time and expertise in the process. And so here, the goal is to directly embed locally the people with an app that will not be as good, certainly, as the best experts in New York and Paris, but that will change, you know, for the fast. This is a field where we need to take fast decisions, because when people are infected, it's a question of hours before you cut the legs or they die. So this is a way, certainly, to have fast decisions in places where expertise is not. And in terms of will it work, I don't know, but certainly when you look at the images, you think that that's the kind of applications where, like this or like this, the current state of the art in machine learning could really help. Okay, so this was the good side, and I skipped one of them, which is about areas I just mentioned images. Let me just say that certainly for images, we have technologies that have progressed very fast in recent years. It's not only images, maybe the second other field that has benefited a lot from progress in machine learning is natural language processing. It's not always apparent when you do automatic translation, but automatic translation does progress very fast. In the last 5 years, we have seen jumps in standard evaluations, speech recognition, all tasks. You know, nowadays you can almost speak in French to someone who speaks some other languages, and we have experiments. It's far from perfect, but at least it starts working a bit when you have automatic translation and phone, etc. So in health, there are many projects like trying to analyze electronic health records, recapitulate the evolution of some patients by combining images and health records and drugs, etc. So this is a hot field. I don't have anything more specific to show, but certainly there is a lot of dynamics, which is, you know, in the spirit of machine learning, to go straight to where are the data, what tasks can we define, and can we try to fit big models that maybe we will not, like, maybe black box models, but that pretty well. All right, so now there are other fields where certainly, even though there are many publications, when you look at the results of publications, it's less a bit less impressive, I would say. So, for example, when you take at, I started my talk saying when you look at cancer in the cells, in the variability, you see differences in mutations, gene expression, methylation, etc. So you could say, well, let's just collect the data, try one of these machine learning models in order to improve our current models to, prognosis, for example. It turns out that it's not so easy. In particular, I think it's key to realize that the success of machine learning also depends on the models we use. I think it was mentioned in the previous talk as well. And the case of images and, to some extent, natural language processing are specific because we have good models that were, we have some intuition about what is an image. It has to be invariant by translation, rotation, scaling, deformations, etc. So all these ideas have been implemented somehow in the models which are used. And I think these models are part of the success. Like if on images, if you forget that what we know about images and say, let's just train a fully connected neural network, it doesn't work at all, right? It's the model plays a role. So when you move to data, so for example, let's look at the second image here, somatic mutations. These are data that we can collect nowadays, and there are many projects aiming at creating big cohorts of patients. So somatic mutations, to be clear, corresponds to when you have cancer, to the mutations that you can observe in the tumor, which are not in the germline genome, right? So these are mutations that were acquired by the tumor during lifetime. And so when you just look at somatic mutations, somehow it's a way to erase the genetic background and just to say we have different individuals which have a different genome, but what we look at is what mutations were acquired by the tumor. And this is often very important because for example, here, so let me explain this picture here. Imagine that the black dots corresponds to the fact that you have a mutation in one gene in one patient. And so horizontally, a row is one patient, and vertically, a column is a gene. So for example, if you have good eyes, you can see some columns here with many black dots. These are genes which are often mutated in some cancers. TP53 is one of them. Okay, so we know when we do population studies, we know that some genes are often mutated, and it's a message, it's a information that probably there is some positive selection pressure on that gene in the context of cancer, and therefore it plays a role. And for many genes where you have frequent mutations, the role has been explained. There is a clear role because these are genes that, once mutated, help the cancer to develop, typically. Right. So now, of course, we can discover genes, but an idea would be, can we maybe go further and, for example, try to train a model that could be simple or complex, we don't care, but that would be good at starting from a profile of somatic mutations, so not only a few of them, but all of them, because we can sequence all the genome. Can we, from a profile, predict whether the patient will respond to a treatment, or predict whether what is the risk of relapse within 5 years, in which case we adapt the treatment if we have a good prediction? Okay. So this is typically, when you formulate it this way, we are not, I don't formulate it as a biomarker, like try to understand the disease. I'm just asking, can we improve the prediction that we use today, because this will directly impact, if doctors use it, this will directly impact how we treat patients. So this is typically something that you can try to solve with logistic regression or more complex models, but this is challenging. And the first challenge is certainly in the numbers, right? So, you know, I said the good machine learning was because we have many data. Here, of course, UK Biobank is a good example. We start having big cohorts, but still these cohorts are tiny. I mean, I don't know what the good ratio here, but the raw number versus the complexity of the data we can collect is very far from what we have in other fields. Right? So remember, we are talking about recognizing cats and penguins on images. To make it work, it seems to be a simple task. You know, you can do it by eyes. We need literally tens of thousands of each class. So, you know, when you have many classes, the typical deep learning models for images were trained on millions of images. Okay? So we need millions of things, but here, because the task is certainly more complicated, like the signal is here, we can expect that it will be challenging to expect to have a magical model reaching, you know, perfect accuracy from just a few hundreds of thousands of samples when you compare it to the number of features you look at. Right. Second thing is the structure, right? There is no clear structure when I say the images are invariant by translations, etc. Here we have no good idea. I mean, this is a research topic, but it's not obvious what would be a good structure of the model to train based on this data. So when you're in a changing situation, there are many problems. One of them is that the accuracy sometimes is not very good. When you compare, this is just to illustrate, when you compare the accuracy of prognosis based only on standard clinical variables versus, in this case, is full gene expression models, there is no impressive gap, like you would say. Suddenly you look at tens of thousands of features, we should do better than just looking at five features. Sometimes you don't see a big jump. Turns out that, you know, this is an old paper a bit, but there has been some follow-up. It's clear that when you have more data, the performance increases. So certainly there is hope to go higher with all the genomic data, but certainly the limitation in N, the number of samples, creates a lack of improvement. Second thing which is common is, so this is not machine, this is statistics, is that when you fit model with you know, small data on large features, many features, it's hard to be robust when you look at markers. So the classical example is the gene signatures. Many people did gene signature for prognosis, and there is basically no overlap at the gene level between them. So it's certainly a property of the fact that you fit models on hundreds of samples in tens of thousands of dimensions. So which is very bad when you think of it as a discovery tool, right? Okay, so what to do, and I will conclude on a few comments on that. So first idea would be, let's collect more data, because certainly more data, as soon as you have some inference process, statistics on machine learning, more data helps. Or maybe if you cannot have more data, improve your models. Just one comment on more data. Certainly more data helps. Now, however, it's clear, there are some theorems, but I will just show a figure. It's clear that the improvement you can get by more data sometimes, I mean, as a decreasing, how do you call that? The rate of improvement decreases with the numbers. Right, so this is just an example, again, on a machine learning task, but which is representative of many other tasks. Suppose you fit a model on data and you say, I want to have more data so that my model gets better. This is the performance vertically of an object recognition tool. So input is image, output is what is the object. Okay, this is a well understood problem. It works well. This is a publication that shows that if you train your model on only 10 million images, this is the small numbers in this field, you get state-of-the-art models, which is good. Now, if you're in a big company, you can afford not having 10 millions, but 30 millions or 100 millions or 300 millions. Right? These are images. We can collect them on the web. And it's very nice to see that our state-of-the-art can be improved significantly. The performance increases. So certainly, having more data, we know when we have more data how to have better models that predict better. But you see that the improvement here, and it's often the case, is logarithmic in the sense that to have, let's say, 1% improvement, you need to multiply your data by a constant factor. Like each time you double your size, you will get your, let's say, 1% improvement. So it's a good news that it's true that more data helps, but realize that, you know, if you say our project today is to have this amount of data, we want to improve, then you have to think in terms of multiplicative factor. Like, should we multiply by 2, by 10, by 100, by 1,000? And each time you multiply by power, you will have a small increase. Okay, so in some fields like images or text or even self-driving cars that can drive, this makes sense because there is basically no limit in the amount of data you can collect. But in medical data, this would certainly be a limitation. All right, so I will certainly stop, I will not go further, but just say that the other option is to try to be smarter and say, well, let's, given that we cannot have 300 million genomes of people with a neuroblastoma, what can we do? Maybe we can be better in the model and be better in the models. I have no magic recipe, but there's lots of research, including prior knowledge, being more constrained. You know, we talked of the link between SNPs and genes and pathways, etc. So there is lots of knowledge in biology that certainly can help reduce the complexity of the space we investigate, and therefore, for a given number of data, increase the power of the model. So not the statistical power, but the accuracy that will result from the model. And a related question, which also I think has been understudied in genomics and this field, is how to represent the data. Like, you know, this is a vector of gene expression. People say, well, when you measure gene expression, you have a table of values, so it's a vector. Then you can make a linear combination, etc. But you could do many other things. You know, think of the mathematical space, etc., the invariance, the technology, etc. And certainly this is less automatic, but there is a lot to be gained here by a finer study of what we know. Just like people did in images and speech about what do we know about images, what is the invariant, what is the signal versus the noise, etc. I think there is not enough study in that, and this kind of big impact on the performance. All right, I'll stop here. And so conclusion, I think there is lots of promise machine learning. Some tools exist nowadays. They will probably impact some part of how we do medicine in different parts of the world. And there are many, many challenges. And I think the question of relating machine learning and statistical approaches is certainly key in some things, especially when we look at discovery. Here I just talk of prediction. Discovering genes or SNPs or causal patterns is a different story, which is also very active in both domains. Thank you for your attention.